Now then, he told the man, you will write a full confession, including names, dates, and places. You will affix your signature to the bottom, and remember, he displayed my Webley beneath Crescendo's running nose, any hesitation, any omission, and we will resume the game with the difference of an actual bullet. The man nodded dully, looking for his handkerchief, and then, remembering the detective had taken it, wiped his nose unceremoniously with the back of his sleeve and sat before his typewriter. Begin with today's date. I, Pavel Krishenov, owner and editor of the broadsheet Bessarabets, do hereby confess that I alone forged and published the document known as the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. I did this at the direction of Pyotr Ivanovich Rakovsky, Director General of the Okhrana, for the purpose of inciting hatred against the Jewish race. Holmes strode about the small room as he alternately dictated and waited while Mrs. Walling translated and Krishenev transcribed her words. I further state that to accomplish this, I plagiarized portions of Monsieur Maurice Joly's. There were fewer hesitations by the typist on this occasion. Krishenev had no need to search for words as Holmes was supplying them. The spider's long legs thwacked the paper in the otherwise silent room. When he had finished, Holmes presented the two pages to Mrs. Walling for her review. She read carefully, silently mouthing the Russian words as we watched, then nodded without speaking, whereupon Holmes set the document before Krishenev and witnessed his signature. After the exhausted man reluctantly affixed his name to both pages, Holmes briskly retrieved and folded them before striking a match and setting fire to our copy of the protocols, placing the smoldering ashes in a nearby dustbin. He then tapped the publisher forcefully on the shoulder, eyeing Mrs. Walling to translate his next words. And be sure, when next you see Director General Rakovsky, to present the compliments of Professor James Moriarty. James Moriarty, he echoed her. Holmes offered a cigarette to Mrs. Walling, and this time she accepted.
Support for this episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere is made possible by the Wessex Press, the premier publisher of books about Sherlock Holmes and his world. Find them online right now at wessexpress.com.
I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, episode 178, The Adventure of the Peculiar Protocols.
I hear of Sherlock Everywhere since you became a chronicler.
In a world where it's always 1895, comes I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, a podcast for devotees of Mr. Sherlock Holmes, the world's first unofficial consulting detective.
I've heard of you before. You're Holmes the meddler, Holmes the busybody, Holmes the Scotland Yard jack in office.
The game's afoot as we discuss goings-on in the world of Sherlock Holmes enthusiasts, the Bigger Street Irregulars, and popular culture related to the great detective.
As we go to press, sensational developments have been reported.
So join your hosts, Scott Monty and Burke Wolder, as they talk about what's new in the world of Sherlock Holmes.
You couldn't have come at a better time!
Well, welcome once again to I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast for Sherlock Holmes devotees where it's always 1895. I'm Scott Monty.
I'm Burt Wolder.
And Burt, I have a sense that I need to install my pop filter in front of my microphone because with the adventure of the peculiar protocols, that's an awful lot of P sounds roaming their way toward the microphone.
Yes. Now, what is that sound called?
It's a plosive, I believe.
It's a what?
Plosive.
Plosive, that's right. Not an implosive or an explosive, but just a plosive.
Maybe a Nancy plosive. Things are explosive in that area. We won't even touch that with a 10-foot pole.
Oh, no, that's very partisan. It's a partisan position to be too plosive about plosive.
Exactly, a partisan plosive issue. Well, we want to avoid all that, and instead we want to lead with something that's very exciting. We have a listener comment from our phone line. That phone line that we ask you to call into every episode, 774-221-READ. Someone has actually taken advantage of that. One of our seven listeners. So, no, I'm sorry, 17. It's canonically appropriate. One of our 17 listeners. And why don't we get right to that right now? And fair warning, it's a two-parter.
Hello, gentlemen. It's Antonio from New Jersey again. I'm calling as a follow-up to what was, to me, a very surprising and very, let's just say surprising moment where I found myself on... I'm going to have to go call you guys back. I'll finish this up in 2 seconds. Hello, gentlemen, again. It's Antonio from New Jersey. Sorry about that interruption before, but actually that interruption, our newborn son, is part of why I'm calling. So backtracking a few weeks ago, I'm on my way home to, you know, welcome our newborn son. My wife goes into the hospital for delivery. I'm on the way back from the city to meet her at the hospital, midday sort of thing. Pop on a podcast to listen to, and lo and behold, what do I hear? Myself. And that's one of those weird, surreal moments in life where you start hearing yourself talk over a podcast and you say, what was I talking about? So I wanted to follow up with a little bit more of a, you know, not such a rambling, hey, I wonder if this number is real sort of thing. So I thought it might be fun since I am holding my son as we speak. And as you could hear before, he wanted to speak himself. I'd love to hear a Trifles podcast about babies and newborns in the canon. I don't know how much fodder there is there, but that being said, I can think of a few examples myself, but I would love to hear both you guys talk about it and maybe give a little Donnie a shout out in that Trifles podcast if possible. That being said, if you decide to play my voicemail, please give me a head up so I can fast forward the 2 minutes of my past my ramblings and just get to the good stuff. Either way, thank you as always. You guys do a great job, and especially have been loving the new Trifle podcast. The last few subjects have been fantastic. Anyways, talk to you soon, and have a wonderful day. Bye-bye.
Well, you see, we are a full-service podcast, if nothing else. Antonio, we've put your comment right up front, so you don't have to fast-forward at all. So there you go.
Well, that's fabulous. And boy, congratulations on Donnie. Lucky Donnie to have a dad who will, at the right time, which is probably only a couple of months away, introduce him to Sherlock Holmes. That's great.
He is probably our youngest listener at this point, I will say. Well, again, congratulations to you, Antonio, and your wife, and welcome to Donnie. And, you know, we did do a Trifles episode not too long ago, episode 97. I guess it would have been about a year ago. Sherlock Holmes and Children. This was, let's see. Yeah, I don't know the exact date on this one. It looks like it was, November of 2018. It's there in the show notes. Of course, you can reach it directly at ihose.co/trifles97. There aren't too many infants in the canon, although we did mention one or two that we came across at that point. So, like our hunting and shooting episode that we just did, there are precious few things to go off of. If we can find more, or if our listeners can clue us in as to more, we will gladly do a babies and infants show to follow up on the Sherlock Holmes and Children show.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a lovely idea.
Hmm.
And, you know, I can think of at least one reference to a baby in the canon. I'm sure there are more. But in Scandal in Bohemia, you know, after the fact of Holmes' masquerade as the clergyman and the smoke rocket and his introduction into Irene Adler's home, he and Watson are having a conversation about, you know, what happened and why and so on and so forth. And I'm pretty sure Holmes says, you know, when a woman thinks that her house is on fire, her instinct is to rush to her most valued possession. And I've taken advantage of that. In the past, you know, a married woman will grab at her baby. An unmarried woman will, you know, look for her jewelry. Something like that.
Yeah.
So I'm pretty sure that's in Scandal, but
that's right.
But that's just a passing reference.
Oh, that's a good one. I like that. You know, in terms of babies, well, you'll have to tune into episode 97 to hear exactly who we mentioned, and see if you can fault us on omitting anything else.
Mm.
But if you would like to join the ranks of Antonio and Donnie, all you have to do to get in touch with us is go to the show notes, ihose.co/ihose178 will bring you to that direct page on ihearofsherlock.com. You can email us at comment@ihearofsherlock.com. You can find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook as I Hear of Sherlock. And, of course, you can call that number, 774-221-READ, 774-221-7323. We would be delighted to hear from you. And whatever device you happen to be listening on, if it is a mobile device, just swipe up or tap that cover art, and you should be able to see the show notes there. Well, we are pleased to welcome back Nicholas Meyer to I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere. You may recall that name, having been on our show previously. Of course, Nick Meyer is not only a member of the Baker Street Irregulars, but probably the individual who was single-handedly responsible for the resurgence of interest in Sherlock Holmes in the 1970s through his seminal pastiche, The 7% Solution. He not only wrote the book, but he wrote the screenplay to the film as well. And of course, you may recall that he directed a little film called Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. Without any further ado, or ego-inflating inducements, here's Nick. Nick, welcome back to I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be back.
Can you believe it's been almost 100 episodes since you've been with us?
No, I can't believe that. I think you're making it up.
Yeah. Well, we had you with us on episode 85. It was quite the conversation. It was a double length because, well, you had a lot of stuff to talk about, a lot of stuff to get off your chest after 40 years. So that was great. But welcome back.
My chest feels so empty now.
Well, we know you're going to fill our minds with lots of interesting stuff. Why don't you refresh our listeners' memory and just give us a quick recap of how you first came across Sherlock Holmes in your life?
Oh, I think I was about 11 years old when my father, who introduced me to, I guess, most things, and from the time I was very small, read me bedtime stories. So I was a big fan of narrative. And I guess when I was about 11, he gave me the Christopher Morley complete Sherlock Holmes in one volume. And, you know, it's a long time ago, but my recollection, certainly it would have been typical of me, is that I probably gobbled the whole thing up over the next, you know, few months. I probably just gorged on all 60 stories.
That's great. And it certainly paid off. As our listeners probably know, you went on to write The 7% Solution in 1974 and followed that just a couple of years later with The West End Horror, and then took, about I guess it was 17 years to come up with a follow-on to that, The Canary Trainer. And here we are 26 years later for the next book. I guess at this kind of calculation, it'll be another 34 years or so before your fifth Holmes book comes out.
Yes, I know my Holmes output is erratic. And the best I can say is that it's not really how I sort of think of myself in terms of making a living. It's more like a treat that I allow myself when I have the time to do a proper job. And also, very infrequently, I guess, do I get an idea that seems to, in my mind anyway, be worth a Holmes treatment. And so I get lots of ideas for lots of things, and most of them I discover are terrible. And they're just not very good ideas. And the more I think about them, the less good they are. So I don't do anything. But once in a blue moon, or once every 19 or 26 years, whatever it is, I'll come up with something, and I would say this will be good for Sherlock. And the adventure of the peculiar protocols, which actually occurred to me for the first time about 10 or 11 years ago, it's just taken me this long to getting around to doing it, is one of those ideas.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that, because we need to be guided by you, because we don't want to deliver any spoilers in this. I think it's safe to say that The Adventure of the Peculiar Protocols begins, as many great moments in Holmes and Watson's life begin, with a summons from Mycroft. And what we know, if we just look at the back of the book will tell us an agent of the British Secret Service has been found floating in the Thames, carrying a manuscript smuggled into England at the cost of her life. And the pages purport to be the minutes of a meeting of a secret group intent on world domination. So it's 1905. So what was it 11 years ago that was the spark for you for this?
Okay. I have been a lifelong, I don't know if aficionado is, I've had a lifelong interest in forgery. As a matter of fact, I realized when I was on my first book tour with the 7% Solution, and I landed in Pittsburgh, and a young reporter met me for an interview, and he said, "How does it feel to be a forger?" And I was startled by this, but, you know, the more I thought about it, I realized, yeah, if you're uncovering Watson manuscripts that were, in fact, written by Arthur Conan Doyle, and even, by the way, if you're leaving Doyle out of the equation, if you're just pretending to be Watson, you're a forger. And I got interested in the whole subject of forgery, which actually raises questions not only of authenticity, but of morality, of economics, of aesthetics. A lot of things are raised by the subject of forgery. What is it? Who does it? Why? What's the difference, for example, between a forgery and a copy? Something you can't see. The intention. Why, if you have two paintings of a smiling lady, and it is scientifically impossible by any means to distinguish one painting from the other, and one smiling woman was painted by Leonardo and the other by me, why is one better than another? And that's a tough question to answer. The best answer I ever heard was somebody said that one could not have existed without the other. In any case, a lifelong interest in forgery, it's only a matter of time before you bump into the most famous vicious and indestructible forgery of all. And that's what I stumbled on, and that's what I decided to write my Sherlock Holmes book about one day.
So in your passion for forgery, have you... I mean, I certainly want to talk more about this, but in your passion and interest and focus on forgery, have you thought about the other side of that coin, you know, authenticity, what the characteristics of authenticity are, creativity, ownership, intellectual property? Because when I hear you talk about that, the first thing I think about, in addition to this case, which is terrific, and it is a monumental forgery that's echoed through the ages, but I also think about Star Trek, and I think about fan fiction, and I think about characters that go into, you know, different realms taken by different people, sometimes with authorization and not. And I'm just curious if, you know, you've thought about authenticity as the other side of that.
Well, I've tried to think, and I may not be the sharpest knife in the drawer, but questions of authenticity, originality, also the legal aspects, copyright, have all sort of floated in and around my brain. But the other thing that made, I think, this book suddenly seem like an idea whose time has come, I think it was Victor Hugo who said there was nothing so irresistible as an idea whose time has arrived, has to do with the entire world in which we presently find ourselves, in which between photoshopping and all kinds of CGI manipulation, it's very hard to tell what's fake from what's real, and we're all pointing at each other like Polish firing squads and saying, this is fake, this is fake, this is fake, this is fake. How do we know what is fake? What is real? And those questions seem more pertinent than ever, because we live in a time when it seems so difficult to distinguish who's telling the truth.
Well, when you pit Sherlock Holmes, who, you know, deals in data and facts, how does a superstar of the detecting field of his era, really for all time, deal with the possibility of fakery, forgery, and the like?
Well, I say up front in the book that this is the account of a failure. And someone said, you know, that a lie can travel halfway around the world while truth is putting on its shoes. It's a sad set of realities that I'm attempting to deal with in a realistic way. One of the things that I've always liked about Holmes is that sometimes he does fail. So I'm not breaking new ground here from either Watson or Doyle, however you choose to view it. So, it, you know, maybe it's a sort of a stealth novel, which is about Holmes, but really about other things. Does that make any sense?
Well, it does. I mean, there's always a, you know, a great subtext, you know, a great subtext to great stories. And I think early, you know, we should point out to our listeners that, look, if you think about the 7% solution as an example, what do you have there? You've got Sherlock Holmes, Vienna, the Orient Express, Sigmund Freud, great characters. And in the same way, in The Adventure of the Peculiar Protocols, we've got notable people from history. We've got societies in turmoil. We've got exotic locations. We've got, you know, many real people. And the lovely couple of lovely things that you've done here in the early part of your book, when you have your introduction, I love your last comment, which is, by the way, if there are any errors of fact or accuracy in here, I just want it clear, you know, these are Watson's, not mine.
Will have my little joke. I have to say that in my opinion, artists are not the best judges of their own work I hate, and I may have said this in episode 84, I hate the word definitive in conversations about either art or biography. I think that artists lose all proprietary authority over their creations when they're finished. And they're sort of out there in the world, and people are just going to make of them what they will. And the artist, his opinion is just one more opinion. So having said that and looking at my four Holmes books from the vantage point of just another opinion, it seems that the 7% solution is less a Sherlock Holmes story than a story about Sherlock Holmes. That the West End horror, by contrast, is a sort of pure Sherlock Holmes case, the only pure one of the four. The Canary Trainer is an experiment to write a novel about Holmes without Watson, which, again, Doyle did this, and with what success or not, it's up to readers to decide. And The Adventure of the Peculiar Protocols is a stealth novel, it seems to me, that uses Holmes to examine something else entirely. Those are my best guesses, but they are not the answer to a book of math equations at the back. They're just somebody's opinion.
Well, in some ways that works better because it's difficult to out-Doyle Doyle, not only as a writer, but as a creator of, you know, the locked room mystery, all the various scenarios that we see in terms of Holmes having to solve some complex enigma or riddle. And I think what you've done by creating a tale that is rich in character, is also rich in plot, but not necessarily dependent upon a successful conclusion. You've opened it up to give yourself a much broader canvas on which to paint. Did you feel like you had that kind of license when you were writing it?
Well, one of the things that I did feel was that I'm 73 years old and I can afford to try stuff which will either work or not, but, you know, I'm sort of too old to apologize. you get to just kind of fool around, and my mother is 93 and she'll tell you exactly what's on her mind.
Well, you've never been a shrinking violet with us, Nick, so we appreciate that.
Well, yeah, one thing I don't seem to be doing is shrinking. I have had a lifetime to think about this stuff and a lifetime to think about a lot of other stuff. And this is what I made of it. It came together, and I asked myself, do you write about a story when Holmes fails? And I said, sure, why not? Do you write about a story where Holmes apparently has some kind of love affair? Sure, why not? I was just trying things and saying, if we don't break new ground, the thing starts to stagnate. There's a kind of fermentation process which may not be beneficial, and it may simply be wiser to try to push the envelope and mix things up a little bit, and try new places. Not necessarily physical places, although quite possibly physical places as well. And I don't think simply putting Holmes in contact with famous people is sort of good enough by itself. That's a kind of, I don't know, sort of lazy creativity. Holmes and you know, Dracula or something. In my view, it has to be in the service of something larger than a gimmick. I don't know that I've always succeeded, but at least that's how I formulate when I sit down to write something. I say about Holmes, I say, what could it be and how could it be that makes it not simply like, oh yeah, we're serving steak and potatoes again tonight. It's, you know, should we try putting a sauce on it or something to make it interesting and unpredictable. Where, you know, I don't know if we had this conversation in episode 84, but did I ever give you my theory about detective stories delivering exactly the opposite of what they promise? Did we ever have that conversation?
I don't.
Let's have it now.
Exactly. Let's do it.
Well, I think that detective stories promise thrills and chills and things that go bump in the night and are horrific, and the body is lying at an unnatural angle and the head has been bashed in by a blunt instrument wielded by person or persons unknown. Sounds pretty hairy. And yet, we like to curl up with a good mystery. I don't know if people take audiobooks to bed with them, but we like to take these books to bed at night and read about all these horrific goings on. It's a kind of comfort food. Now, why should this be, since they're purporting to be pretty bloody and violent? And the answer seems to be that, in contrast to real life, which is a random, arbitrary, meaningless proposition in which people die for no reason whatever, in detective stories, nothing ever happens without a reason. And when the detective says, it all adds up, it sure does. It always adds up. Now, there are detective stories that transcend this sort of limited view of what a detective story is. What's the greatest detective story is probably Oedipus. Guy goes searching for the murderer, and the big shocker is that the murderer is himself. That's hard to top. But it also has to do with larger questions of fate, free will, destiny, acceptance of fate, a lot of big issues. But for most detective literature, and there's no shortage of it, as we know, book after book after book and TV show after TV show, things happen for reasons, as opposed to life, in which things do not happen for reason. You get struck by lightning, you get cancer, whatever, you get hit by a falling barbell, when I was 12 years old, I saw that happen. I was walking to a piano lesson, and I saw a man in front of me, his head exploded, and he died. And he died because a barbell that had been propping open a window in a bathroom in an apartment above had been dislodged by whoever was cleaning the bathroom, the maid, and it fell down and it killed this person. There's no reason for that. And in fact, in the Dashiell Hammett novel of the Maltese Falcon, Sam Spade tells Bridget O'Shaughnessy a story that she fails utterly to understand. It's about a man who's on his way to work when he's hit by a brick from a falling construction site and he's killed. The story is not about that man. The story is about the man behind him who looks and sees that this meaningless event has occurred, and he thinks, what's the point of life? Why am I even going to work? Why do I even have a family? Why am I even bothering? And so he doesn't go to work, and he wanders around, and he finds himself in another city, and then he gets hungry, so he has to get a job in order to make some money to get something to eat, and then he feels lonely, so he finds a girlfriend, and then he marries, and in short order realizes that he's no farther away from the brick than he was when the thing fell on the guy in front of him to begin with, that there's no escaping that kind of random, arbitrary thing. Well, as I say, I was that kid. I was on my way to a piano lesson. So detective stories were always tremendously reassuring to me, whether it was Sherlock Holmes or Hercule Poirot or the Hardy Boys. I read all that stuff, and it was very, very comforting. It is comforting, but that's not what it promises. It promises something very different. And the best of it, by the way, somehow manages to be very different. If you look at Mystic River, that movie, boy, oh boy, oh boy.
When the ancient Anglo-Saxon kingdom of Wessex was invaded by the Danes in 871, King Alfred the Great had to pay them to leave. That's why securing your borders is more important than ever, even if you don't own a rooming house. Yes, we can learn a lot from the past, and now you can look back to the first 6 months of 1893, when Sherlock Holmes and Arthur Conan Doyle were all the rage. In your copy of Sherlock Holmes and Conan Doyle in the Newspapers, Volume 2, from the Wessex Press, where you'll chart the rise and fall of Conan Doyle and J.M. Barrie's comic opera Jane Annie, and see Sherlock Holmes begin to achieve literary and cultural immortality, all for a modest $28.95. Friends, the trees are in their autumn beauty and the woodland paths are dry. On this fall afternoon, reach for the pleasure only a volume from the Wessex Press can provide. Choose yours today.
It's a lot to think about. And, the lovely thing is the degree to which you've thought and felt deeply about the motivating character, the motivating spark behind the adventure of the Peculiar Protocols in this eternal calumny that's gone down over the centuries. It's fair to say that there's a theme too, as you look at the book, which I'm sure you're sensitive to because you wrote it, which is, and you talked earlier about the fact this is essentially a failure about Holmes. And you also have just spoken very eloquently about the randomness and meaninglessness of existence. And that theme is, people will believe what they want to believe. And
well, that's what Watson says in the book, doesn't he? He said people will believe what they want to believe. And or later, does he amend it to saying people will believe what they need to believe?
Yeah.
We're hardwired. I think scientists have, in trying to explain the intransigent divide that seems to characterize our country now, whether you're either a pro-Trump person or an anti-Trump person, that facts seem to be irrelevant. John Adams said that facts are stubborn things, but hardwired brains seem to be equally stubborn. And when you listen to people talk or argue or yell, they seem to be sort of unable to hear what one another is saying. They're so intent on what they're, Hamlet says there is nothing good or bad, but thinking makes it so. And our brains, I think, are not quite the dispassionate evaluators of information that we sometimes wish they were. Or maybe there are people who don't wish they are. It's hard to disentangle your emotional involvement from something that is objective in the sense that John Adams says facts are stubborn things. Maybe we can all agree that George Washington was the first president of the United States. Maybe we can say that's a fact. But after that, we're in the weeds.
You think about this from the standpoint of a storyteller with your series of Holmes books, but many other things, Has your approach to storytelling changed at all? Because one of the things I'm curious about is, you know, because your output is prodigious and continues, if with all of the characteristics of today's environment, of modern readers, of the need apparently for certain generations need for brevity, exactly, which is unlike my question, so you can tell how old I am. Is all of that, you know, affected the way you tell stories, the way you put this book together?
That, if I may say so, is a terrific question. And I don't know that I've been asked it. And let me chew on this, because I think that in some ways, not politically, but certainly aesthetically, I'm some kind of arch conservative. I really love the once upon a time of it all. I recognize that attention spans have gotten shorter, that as there are more things clamoring for our attention. It used to be there were three channels. There was ABC, CBS, and NBC, and now there's 300 channels. There's YouTube videos. There's, you know, you look at stuff on your phone. And I recognize all that. And I try to acknowledge and learn from what is going on around me and what, I hate this phrase, young people are sort of into. But at the same time, I don't want to surrender my own sort of aesthetic or narrative values. I was delivering a text of a speech to somebody, and I said, Holmes and his amanuensis. And somebody said, gee, don't you think you better just say Dr. Watson? And I said, no, I am not going to dumb down my vocabulary. If you don't know the word, then go look it up. I don't believe it is part of my function to censor myself, to pull punches. I want to just sort of be who I am and nail my colors to the mast. I don't want to watch Lawrence of Arabia on my smartphone. I just don't. I don't want to surrender. Here's another, you know, peeve is too small a word for, or weak a word for what I'm talking about. But I really believe in a theatrical experience, by which I mean an experience that includes an audience, a whole bunch of people that you don't know them, they don't know you. You come together for the purpose of doing this thing. You turn off your f***ing phone, you sit there in the dark, and you share an experience that is unique. You will laugh and cry with people that you don't know. They don't know you. And there's something good about that coming together, which I worry we're losing if we're having all our theatrical and emotional aesthetic experiences on a smartphone and something that lasts 30 or 40 seconds, and that's it. And I don't want to be part of that. I might want to learn from it. I might want to take things from it, but I will apply them to my own stubbornly held views of what is narratively meaningful or interesting to me. I certainly would never tell you a joke that I didn't think was funny on the off chance that you might find it funny. If I don't find it funny, I'm not going to get the laugh. I just know it. I've experienced it. That may be an unrelated remark. So
it's not an unrelated remark. People tend to share things that they have a passion, interest, and a better reaction to, you know. So you're not going to toss out something and say, well, here's an idea, and I didn't care for it, but maybe you will. I mean, that's not going to go very far.
Yeah.
Well, that's for the art. Anyway, listen, I just think that that somebody said that laughter is a shared experience. I think that drama is a shared experience. And I like the commitment of it. I like getting out of the house. I find it interesting that movie theaters increasingly are being, they're trying to make it like your living room where your chair reclines and you sit there with a beer. And at home, they keep trying to make screens bigger and bigger so that it resembles a theater.
I'm waiting for the time in the movie theater where I can pause the screen when I have to go to the bathroom and then resume it when I come back into the theater.
I'm sure that's the – and people – I just like – I like going to the movies. I'm a dummy. I'm not very interested in 3D. I'm not very interested in a lot of technological stuff. I'm just interested in the story. Mm. I'm very interested in people trying to figure out stuff. And movies, certainly studio movies, have sort of left that all behind in favor of wind-up toys and special effects and sort of eye candy. But there is still room for, I just saw a movie called Official Secrets that I thought was terrific. I saw a documentary called Maiden about these 12 women who sailed around the world in the Whitbread yacht race, 32,000 miles to go around the world, the longest race there is. And I am totally enthralled by this stuff. I had a good time at that movie Hustlers with Jennifer Lopez because you can't take your eyes off her. But I like it with the popcorn and I like it with the people that you don't know.
Yeah.
And books is a different experience. That is a solo experience, unless you're, taking turns reading it out loud, which I've also done, and that's fun too. Mm. It tests the writing when you read it out loud.
Yeah.
Well, and that gets us back to the adventure of the Peculiar Protocols. And, one of the things I was curious about was your research. I think you mention it a little bit in the book, but I'm curious, you must have enjoyed learning more about 19-5 and some of these people and the dynamics of the world at that time. How long did your research take you?
Well, it's sort of a deceptive question. It's a more complicated question. People would say, how long did it take you to, write this book? As if they were talking really about the physical a task in which you can say, oh, yes, it took me, 3 months or 6 months or whatever it was. But really, that fails to take into account the period of gestation in which you're sort of dreaming it up. Now, everybody creates differently. Everybody falls asleep differently. Some people lie on their back. Some people face plant. Some people use a mask over their eyes or something, or listen to music or sound. Everybody gets there their own way. So when I relate what my writing method is, I don't pretend to say that it is or ought to be anybody else's writing method. But I think we're all sort of the sum product of our lives to the point that is now, this moment. And in my case, there's been a lifetime of reading a lot of history, a lot of biography, collecting a lot of miscellaneous information that seems to be of no use or interest to anyone except possibly yourself. So I had read, Barbara Tuchman, the Proud Tower,
right,
and Barbara Tuchman, The Guns of August, and a lot of Edwardian material. I watched the Eisenstein movie, The Battleship Potemkin, which is one of my favorite movies. So there was a lot of stuff that was sort of already in place. Then when you come to what research specifically did I do for this book, a professor, Steven Zipperstein, wrote a book about pogroms in Russia. And he wrote about this pogrom that took place in 1903, which really contained a tremendous amount of information that just fed into the whole now's the time to write this Sherlock Holmes book. At the same time, I've also been a lifelong fan, well, lifelong, 30 years, of the musical Fiddler on the Roof. And Fiddler on the Roof, which takes place more or less in the same time and place and could be the same town as the events that Holmes winds up investigating in Russia. This all fed into, in fact, on the 23rd of October in New York at the 92nd Street Y, I'm going to appear with Joel Grey, who has a new production of Fiddler running in New York that he directed, which is in Yiddish, which he doesn't speak, by the way. And it's going to be called Holmes and Tevye, Fiddlers on the Roof, to discuss precisely this period and these events, which all have fed into. Now, having said all of that in terms of, you know, what went into this book, and you said, and the research that happened sort of as I was, or while I was writing, or immediately before writing this book, a surprising amount, surprising to me anyway, takes place online. I have all these reference books. I love encyclopedias and dictionaries and concordances, but I turn to them less and less because I can just go to Google and look, go online and look things up, and you'll find out. You want to know what happened every year in every month in 1905? Yeah, just click the mouse, and it will tell you. So there was a lot of information that I was gaining simultaneously as I was doing a lot of the writing. That's a very long-winded, I guess I am long-winded, answer to this whole question of research and timing and how long did it take. But Madame de Staël wrote somebody a letter and she said, I'm sorry, this is such a long letter. I didn't have time to make
time
it in order.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do a sure one.
That's fascinating. And, you know, obviously over the course of your writing career, both professional and a Holmesian, if we can separate those two as different beasts, the research process has changed. You know, you don't have to go to a major research organization or spend a day at the New York Public Library in the archives or send away for, microfiche or anything like that. It's all at the fingertip. And This is true.
It does simplify. And whether simplifying is a good thing or not remains to be seen. But yes, you are. It is easier to access tremendous amounts of data. The difficulty is sort of being able to conscientiously sift through the wheat from the chaff and not go wandering.
Well, that's where I wanted to go with that, because as a storyteller, you know, when you're assembling information the good old fashioned way, and you've got your index cards or your post-it notes or a whiteboard or however it is that, you know, one assembles research in preparation for a story, it allows a little more reflection. It allows you a chance to, in some cases, physically move around, your notes. How have you found this incredible ocean of data that you now have at your fingertips? How does that affect you as a storyteller?
It's a good question. Your questions are good questions. It's very difficult, I think, for someone like me to discern or to easily discern or distinguish what is important from what is unimportant, because there is simply so much information that you can wander, you know. And what I've discovered, I'll give you two analogies. One is painting stage scenery. When you're putting on a play and there's a set, the only thing that needs to be realized is the part that can be seen by the audience. You don't have to go off into the wings and keep, you know, putting on the moldings and the windows and the doorknobs or whatever. Or it's only what the audience can see from their seats that is pertinent. And the temptation sometimes to just keep on painting off into the wings is hard to resist. And you have to remember that you're telling a story and not writing some kind of exegesis on, I don't know what, the period, the whatever. So don't get carried away with stuff that doesn't feed into the central viewable thing. The other example I was going to give is when you're making a film and you go on a location scout and you're looking for something and you're in Italy and you're looking for something Roman, but you find these wonderful Renaissance somethings in this town and you go, wow, that's really cool. And then somebody says, no, don't stop and look at the Renaissance stuff. You're not here for that. You're not a tourist. You're working. And what you're looking for, you're not finding. So it's time to leave and go to the next place. So there is some discipline that is sometimes very tricky to keep your mind, at least keep my mind, on what I'm supposed to be doing, as opposed to saying, well, wow, I'm wandering around this bookstore and that thing with the red cover looks really cool. And even though it's, you know, listed in economics and I'm looking for Etruscans, you have to sort of prevent yourself from wandering over to the red thing and saying, oh, I want to look at that. I want to look at these Renaissance ruins. I want to keep painting into the, is this making any sense?
Absolutely.
Otherwise you get lost. You get lost in a plethora of, you know, and sometimes some of those journeys will surprise you and they may be actually rather useful. And that makes it even worse.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because you go, well, yeah, this is cool. You know, maybe we should use this. And I think sometimes, you know, I do get lost. And I'm tempted to throw in information for its own sake, just because it seems so cool. But it runs the risk of impeding the narrative momentum, the flow.
Right. And that gets back to what you were saying earlier, that this has to be done as something in the service of something larger than a gimmick. And these sidetracks can, you know, while they're not gimmicky, they can certainly be distracting and not leading toward the overall end of the story.
They can be distracting. And, you know, if you're putting famous people in, that's a different kind of distraction.
Yeah, sure. Unless
they are absolutely germane to what's going on.
Final question for you, Nick. As you think about the totality of these four Sherlock Holmes novels that you have, and if a listener were to come to this, perhaps they are new to the world of Sherlock Holmes, perhaps they are a new reader, a new devourer of a certain genre of literature, and they've just discovered you, what would your recommendation be to those people in terms of the order of reading your Sherlock Holmes books?
God, you've got the best question. Wow, what to say? How to sound smart.
Wait, your publisher would say, buy this book first, I'm sure.
You know, it's interesting because there are two ways to think about these books, or in, again, just my opinion. And one way is that you can think about them as the order in which I wrote them. The other way, perhaps, is you can think about them in Holmesian chronology, the order in which they take place. I think, and I could be mistaken, that the 7% solution takes place in 1891, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the Canary Trainer is really the sequel to the 7% solution, because Holmes does not go back to his life, he goes to Paris, and that's where the canary trainer takes place. So that would seem like the second one. The third one takes place, I believe, in March of 1895. So again, if you were following Holmesian chronology as opposed to Meyer chronology, the canary trainer would be second, and the West End Horror would be third, 1895, and the Adventure of the Peculiar Protocols, 1905, would be the fourth.
Well, that makes great sense. I love the reasoning behind it, and to any Sherlockian that would resonate, I'm sure. Well, the book is The Adventure of the Peculiar Protocols by Nicholas Meyer. It is available from Minotaur Books and, of course, is available wherever you get your books, whether it's the local bookshop, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or what have you. Go out and get yourself a copy. It drops today, the same day that this show is dropping, October 15th, 2019. Nick, from the bottom of our hearts, thank you for being with us again.
I was extremely flattered to be asked, and the questions were really good, I got to tell you, because sometimes I just have to interview myself. So it was great that you did the heavy lifting. Thank you.
Excellent. Well,
thank you. I really enjoy talking to Nick, and this has been a great conversation because we haven't talked to him too much in the past about, you know, the craft of fiction, and I was really interested in what he has to say, and our listeners will be interested in connecting to him in person. He is on a book tour. He is, and in sort of increasing order, right now on October 15, he is at Diesel Books in Santa Monica. He will be at Otto's Mysterious Bookshop on October 21, and I'm going to try to run in and actually purchase a copy of this.
Oh, great.
He'll be at the – but you say you're not satisfied. So he is at Otto's Mysterious Bookshop in Lower Manhattan on October 21. He'll be at the Folger Shakespeare Library in Washington, D.C. on October 26th. He'll be in Phoenix on October 31st at the Poisoned Pen. Then he'll be at the Hammer Museum in Los Angeles on November 8th, where there's a showing of the 7% Solution. In November 13, he's somewhere in New Jersey, which I'm interested to finding out more about. On November 30th, he's on two panels at a sci-fi festival at the LAX Airport Marriott. December 5th, he's in Minneapolis. December 6th, he's in Austin, Texas, where he thinks they're showing Time After Time, the picture he directed with, if memory serves, Malcolm McDowell and Mary Steenburgen. So you can connect with Nick on his nationwide tour.
And Nick, if you are still listening, I will send you my email address so you can share your frequent flyer miles with me as you round out this book tour.
Yeah.
What a remarkable schedule. And quite frankly, I think any of the audiences that show up for this, whether he's doing a reading or a Q&A or a combination of both, obviously you are in for a real treat. Because you heard Nick talking to us about the art of storytelling and the art of writing. And Nick, as you heard from episode 85, if you've listened to that, and if you haven't, please go back and do that. Nick is the consummate raconteur. He is able to bring us on a journey with him and make it interesting and make us understand what goes into the mind of a creator as he or she is trying to share with the world what their creation is all about.
Yeah. And he, this isn't part of his book tour, but I just remembered he's also, speaking of creativity, he's also on doing a program with Joel Gray. And Joel, if you remember, was in the 7% Solution.
Oh, that's right.
at the 92nd Street Y in Manhattan on October 23rd, and I'm going to go in for that too. Very interesting. They're talking about Holmes and also about Fiddler on the Roof and Tevye, and I'm very interested to now, two prominent fiddlers, of course. Of course, Tevye wasn't actually a fiddler. It was an analogy, but I'll be interested to see what that's all about. So that should be fun.
Well, if I were a rich man, I'd fly into New York and join you.
You wouldn't just biddy biddy bum? That's pretty good.
Well, speaking of biddy biddy bum, it's time for Canonical Couplet. I don't know how that segue makes any sense, but that's all I've got. It's everyone's favorite Sherlockian quiz show. This is the section of each episode where we put in front of you a two-line poem that relates to one of the 60 Sherlock Holmes stories. And we ask you to identify that story by virtue of hearing those two lines. And the last time we were with you, we asked you to identify this story. A curse-encumbered household in the West, inspired of all the detective stories, is best. Bert, do you know which Sherlock Holmes story that refers to?
Oh, yeah, of course. Absolutely. It's very easy. That's The Hound of the Boscombe Valley, isn't it?
so close. I think the hound in this instance occupied a section of the country that was a little further west. And that would make him the Hound of the Baskervilles.
Oh, dear. Yeah. I always forget that part.
Yeah. Well, the Baskervilles were not known to settle in other areas of England, so they are way out west. In this case, we had a number of entries, and we did something a little different this time around because we wanted to encourage as much participation as we could. We actually put out an audio clip just of the Canonical Couplet, so people wouldn't have to figure out where in the episode the quiz is. Now, I know that's cheating a little bit, but what it did was encourage more people to participate, and we hope more will in the future. So, we're going to have to spin the extra-large prize wheel this time as we look at those numbers go around and wait for it to land on number 25. Number 25, and that corresponds to Mark Anderson. Mark, congratulations.
Hooray!
We will get in touch with you and send you a prize from the IHO's vaults in the coming days. And now, that means it's time for this episode's Canonical Couplet. Here we go. When a man of questionable ethics lays his past bare, only photographic proof can spoil the affair. If you think you know the answer to this episode's Canonical Couplet, jot it in an email and send it to comment@iHearOfSherlock.com with Canonical Couplet in the subject line. If you are among the correct answers and we choose your name at random, you'll win the prize. Good luck.
Excellent.
All right. Well, it's another fine episode we have here. I think this is good for October. You know, October is a month of surprises and spooky delights, and between all of the conversation and the topics that we've covered in this episode, I think that pretty well reflects October.
I think you're right. Well, you know, it's sort of trick or treat. It could be trick or twisted lip. It could be your twisted lip costume. You know, I always like to dress up, you know, as the amateur mendicant himself, and put on my scar face and join the kiddies as we go from house to house, tipping over garbage pails and insisting on chocolate.
And you wondered why your house was covered in eggs and toilet paper by the end of the weekend.
Yeah. Yeah. I always thought it was like, you know, this bizarre barometric disturbance. Maybe there's something more to it.
Well, friends, thank you for joining us for this episode. Stay tuned so you can join us again in episode 179. Who will it be? Will it be a trick? Will it be a treat? You'll have to tune in and see. And meanwhile, this is always the treatful Scott Monty.
And I am the inevitable Burt Walder.
And together we say,
The
game's afoot.
The game's afoot.
I'm afraid that in the pleasure of this conversation, I'm neglecting business of importance, which awaits me elsewhere.
Thank you for listening. Please be sure to join us again for the next episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast dedicated to Sherlock Holmes.
Goodbye, and good luck, and believe me to be, my dear fellow, very sincerely yours, Sherlock Holmes.